As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville.
Baseball Hall of Famer Jason Stark.
And then the robot said, strike.
That's why you're going in the Hall of Fame.
It's an inside the park home run, Doug Glanville.
Mike Trout is coffee at Starbucks with a double latte skinny.
Doug, are you ready to make some podcast magic?
I am ready. Bring on the magic wand. Let's do it.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville. I'm Jason Stark. I write about baseball for The Athletic, and I'm joined once again by my good friend, writer, broadcaster, professor, distinguished former major leaguer, and the voice of the Home Run Derby coming up this week on ESPN Radio, Doug Glanville. Doug, happy 4th of July weekend. You want to update our listeners about the big holiday festivities in Starkville that they should definitely put on their calendars?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm trying to figure out if we have an Independence Day. so I'm trying to figure out, did we secede from some union or break away from a larger island? I'm not really sure about that, but I kind of feel like we may have just like come out of dust. You know, we just like formed in the middle of a body of ocean of water. I'm not sure which one, though. If it's, you know, Starkville, there's other things that are other planetary. So are we on Earth? We'll say yes, but sometimes we're not. So that's the fun of it. But so I think we, you know, if we think about what we would celebrate, we need our own holidays. We have enough statues now for 365 days. So we need now our own holidays, and we should celebrate our independence. And we could just say it's celestial. Independence from space, and maybe that's what we do. We just sort of embrace it that we're not from here.
Okay, so all our celebrations would be at night because then that's where the moon is, and we can make sure we keep our distance from the moon.
Yeah, you could say that, or the sun. Maybe we celebrate on an eclipse. But I'm going to write something out. Yeah, We need holidays. And I think each week is like a holiday. I feel the celebration, but I'd like to really blow something up at a larger scale and declare our own independence from independence.
Wow. That's deep. I'll think about that one. Look, the 4th of July is such an upbeat holiday. So we want to make sure that we bring everyone back down to earth this week. So we're going to talk about the Mets. Nothing makes us feel more goosebumpy and upbeat about life these days than the Mets, don't you think? So we'll have our two great Mets writers, Tim Britton and Will Salmon, on to just discuss the deadline, Steve Cohen's fascinating meeting with the media, and other warm and fuzzy Mets topics. But first, Doug, just quickly, it's All-Star time. We now have two full All-Star teams named. There are, just to recap, there are many, many Braves. There are many, many Rangers. It's you and I will both be in Seattle next week. I wanted to ask you a question that has kept talk shows, and America's most beloved podcasts humming for years. Here it is. Who is not on the All-Star team whom you would love to see in Seattle next week? I'm just going to warn you before you answer. In my case, it's a trick question, but you can answer however you like.
It's a trick question. Interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, you talk about snubs. I think I got this right, but I don't know if I saw Juan DeFranco on this list. Is he on there?
He's not on the list. That's why you never saw him on the list.
Yeah, that's why. So I'm going to, well, since we're talking about our independence, I'm going to write a citation out about snubs. We're going to have to come up with a snub library. So Juan DeFranco, that's pretty shocking to me because this guy is phenomenal. And that's pretty much what I have to say. Just the stolen bases, the switch hitting, the discipline, the excitement, the clutch hitting, phenomenal player. I mean, I know there is some depth there at the position, but wow, Juan DeFranco is special player. So I'm going to throw him up there as kind of my top guy I'd like to see and not going to get a chance to.
Okay, well, that's a great name. And I can actually help you with that with my name because my name is Elly De La Cruz from the Reds. And I understand he's only been in the big leagues for 15 minutes. 23 games, actually. So it really isn't fair for him to be an all-star over Fernando Tatis Jr. or Ketel Marte or a bunch of other names. There's no argument from me on that. But here's the deal. See, I don't want him to replace anyone on the team. I've been saying for years, baseball should have a bonus roster spot, a rising star roster spot on the All-Star team for players like him, you know, young players that people are buzzing about that we should make sure are on the team in this game on a night when millions of eyeballs are watching. What do you think, Doug?
I love it. I think it's a great idea. I mean, you talk about stars, you say rising stars. I like that. When you're thinking about, you know, bringing the game to young people, promoting it, making it grow with wider arms for a world of fans that you're trying to reach, nothing better than get the young rising stars out there amongst the other stars and give that lifelong experience, not only to him, but just the fans to see, because he's so exciting. And I can't imagine Nickel or whatever, all the things he's been able to do. So I love it. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. And so I could help you with your snub. By the American League, we could make Wander Franco the rising star and get him on the team that way. Or if he gets named to the team, I was thinking Joan Duran, the incredible Twins closer. There are a bunch of guys. See, they don't have to be rookies. I would just make it like guys who are 25 or under, or, you know, third year in the big leagues or less, whatever, just to make sure the world knows about them. Promote the stars, show people the future. Remember, this is about entertainment and buzz factor. That's my big brainstorm. I've been throwing it out there for years. You know, I used to have another idea. Maybe you remember this, the Living Legend Award. And you know what happened? Baseball actually did that. They threw it into the last labor deal. So last year at the game, Rob Manfred named Miggy and Albert to the team with like basically the Living Legend spot. Not sure whether it's happening this year. There've been some Craig Kimbrell rumors, but here's the thing. Like normally, if there's one thing you can count on, it's that if I have a brilliant idea, it has zero chance of actually happening. So don't look for the rising stars idea to actually happen anytime soon.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. And by the way, the Living Legend was brilliant. I mean, what Albert Pujols did for all those players in the home run derby. And it was
in
awesome.
That derby, right?
It was awesome. I mean, I filmed it, just like how much and respect that all these players from generations. I think that was a great idea. And why not do the flip of that? Like who's coming up to carry that torch. I think it's phenomenal. So good ideas. Yep.
Thank you. Make it happen, will you? Cause I can't.
All
All right, Doug, why don't we turn to the Mets season, which has been quite the soap opera. And it's going to get even more interesting in the next few weeks with that trade deadline approaching. So why don't we bring in our friends Tim Britton and Will Salmon, who cover the Mets for The Athletic and so far have lived to tell about it. So, Tim, Will, welcome to Starkville.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Looking forward
Great
to it.
Great to have you here. So, Tim, I was reading your This Week in Mets column this morning, as I do every week. And we're going to overlook the part where you quoted William Faulkner from a book you said you were
correct. Yes, that is you can quote a lot of books as long as you don't have to finish them. That's a key strategy.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's where the whole quote concept comes in. But we're going to move past that. It might return at some point, but I'm just looking at the links to the stuff that you guys have written about in the last week. It's funny. You'd almost get the impression the Mets aren't having that good a year. Okay, so let me read a couple of these. Was June the worst month in Mets history? If the Mets are this bad in 2023, what does it suggest for 2024? And those are just the highlights. Tim, was that the most depressing series of links you've ever posted?
It's up there. You know, I've only covered this team for six seasons. So there have been some ups and downs during that stretch, certainly. But you know, I wrote that, was this the worst month in Mets history? And when I started that, I thought, no way. I mean, clearly this is a team that played from 1962 to 1968 and was not very good that entire stretch. They had several months where they lost a lot more games. But when you factor in expectations and kind of the quality, the style of losses, like they were 12 games under 500 in June with a minus 11 run differential. They lost a lot of close games in brutal fashion. Then you start to think, you know, maybe this is right up there in like August 2021 when they went from first place to well out of it in just 31 days. This had the same feel as that month.
And September of 2007 was also in there, which is a pretty historically bad month. What did you decide which of those 2 months was worse?
I think September 2007 still takes the cake. You know, the overall, they went 500 that month, so you've got to give them some credit for that. But really, I think they started that month 10-2 and then went, you know, 4-12 down the stretch. And when you do that, that kind of just highlights the absurdity of that stretch down the end of the season and blowing that lead to the Phillies.
Yeah, the 4-12 part seems to make people forget the 10-2 part for some reason.
Don't know why.
Yeah. Okay. But anyway, hey, at least you're stopping by after the Mets just did something they had not done in weeks, which was win two games in a row and win a series against the Giants. So what do you think, guys? Here they come. Rip off maybe 20 more wins in a row and they can pull within 15 games of the Braves.
That assumes Atlanta would lose in that stretch, which they haven't really done. Yeah. I think, I don't know what their record in June was last year when they went on that. They won, I think, 15 in a row at some point last year. Now they've won 16 out of 17. That's another layer to the Mets month of June. They lost 19 games. Atlanta, Miami, and Philly, the three teams ahead of them in the East, combined to lose 20. So it like, you know, talking about losing ground, they lost it really swiftly in that month.
Yeah, it really is amazing to think there was a time we thought Braves Mets was a coin flip in the NL East. I think we've removed that part of the conversation. The Mets, though, are 8 games back of the last playoff spot with practically the whole league ahead of them. So I want to ask you guys a question that I asked Steve Phillips a week or so ago on MLB Network. Are the Mets still contenders? Can we even use that word? Will, what do you think?
Well, Tim wrote this morning in his weekly column. If you win another game, it's actually called a winning streak. And so the problem with the Mets is that their ability to mount a winning streak depends probably on their ability to do one or two things really well that propels them to that winning streak. And right now we're just not seeing it. Like defensively, they're not very good. Pitching, not very good. Hitting, probably about average, maybe a little bit better, depending on how healthy the lineup is, but not enough to really propel and mount a large winning streak, the kind of winning streak that you need to sort of convince people and convince your own players, frankly, that this is possible, that you could win 5 or 6 in a row and get really back into the hunt. Until we see some sort of semblance of that, it's hard to really say that they're take them like legitimate, take them seriously. Do they have the talent? Of course, yeah. But that's been the story for what, more than 81 games now. So it's not something where we could fall back on it and just say that it's, they're going to play to their level. You know, to borrow a phrase, paraphrase from Buck Showalter. We're just not seeing that. We haven't seen that for more than a few months now.
Yeah, just to amplify those things that you just mentioned, ninth in the National League in runs scored, 12th in starting pitching ERA, 10th in bullpen ERA, and Fangraphs has them rated as the second worst defensive team in the league. Feels like to be a playoff team, you should at least be good at something. Doug, you just saw the Mets. What did you see?
Well, and I'm curious to – I'm always searching for, you know, what is the one thing – what is the thing that sort of set them into a kind of a tailspin season in a, right? Is that, and I'm curious to hear from both of you guys about, like, you know, you look at Edwin Diaz, okay? Everybody can say, especially you mentioned the close games in this bad month, so to speak. You look at, you know, there's been a lot of anecdotal around the pitch clock and having these veteran senior pitchers. But so, you know, so I look at them and I saw some games where they really look, you know, they won some close one-run games. You're like, yeah, this team is on point. But I'm curious what you gentlemen think about that thing that you circle, if you say this is really the key element. Because sometimes those things are like symptomatic of missing something key, right? Okay, you lose these games, you can't get it together, but it may be a key figure or a key policy change or whatever it may be. So what do you see? And I'll start with you, Will.
Yeah, I think like a lot of things when it comes to the Mets, it's more than one thing. So I think Tim and I both will have a list of things that we could kind of point to without even probably saying the same thing. I'll start with the Diaz, with mentioning Edwin Diaz, like you did, Doug. I think at the start, when he first goes down with the season ending injury, your thought, or at least most of the thought around the Mets was, okay, they could overcome this because it's a closer. He pitches maybe one inning. They have David Robertson. They have a few guys who could get into like these bigger roles. But what we've seen actually is that there was a large trickle down effect after a while, because I think the first month or so of the season, we did see the bullpen not be the ones who were responsible for the losses. It was other things. But what happened was over time, the Mets starting pitching, they were never able to really get into the sixth inning, let alone much deeper than that. They were settling for five and less almost every single time. And what that did was it had a cascading effect on some of these other middle relievers that they were using. And they got to the point where they're almost burning them out. And it first started with some good performances where they would rely on a couple of guys for bulk innings. But after a time, like, these guys were in those spots because they're frankly not good enough to be high leverage guys. So eventually you're going to run into poor performance or injury. For the Mets, a lot of it was poor performance. And then you had the trickle down effect of, you're using guys who you thought were going to be pitching the sixth and seventh inning and are now pitching maybe the eighth inning for Adam Ottavino or Brooks Raley, because Buck Showalter is really obsessive when it comes to not trying to or preventing injury with his bullpen, to the point where he'll sacrifice a game even where like it's a marginal time to bring in one of those guys for rest. And we've seen that happen as well. So I think that's a huge part of it, where they got into a situation where they were playing those one run games like we talked about before. And they had to rely on Brooks Raley, David Robertson, Adam Ottavino, and they were at least a reliever or two short in that, especially after the Diaz injury. So I think that part of it kind of corresponds with the pitching problem, where we're seeing from the beginning of the year, they just never were able to get that length. And this was a team that was built primarily on pitching and defense. And those are two areas that we have not seen it to be at all good enough or up to par based on what the standard was.
I look at it as, you know, a kind of a bizarro version of last year's team. Last year's team won 101 games. There was nothing they did, you know, there was no one thing they hung their hat on. Maybe it was Diaz in the ninth inning. That was the dominant part of their team. But everything else was just, you know, they were good at everything. They had a pretty good defense. They had a pretty good offense. They had a pretty good starting rotation and a pretty good bullpen. You put all of those things together in today's Major League Baseball, you can win 101 games, especially if you get, you know, some chemistry, some magic in the middle of the season like they had. Whereas this year, they're just pretty bad at everything. Like, you know, it's not this huge drop off offensively, but it's enough to take them from above average to a little bit below average. The starting rotation has had the drop off. The bullpen's had the drop off. The defense might have had the biggest drop off, actually, the way they've played over the last month. But like Will has said, you know, the way the pitching staff, it's that trickle down effect from not having Diaz to your middle relief. The starters not going deep exacerbates that issue. Your offense scoring a little bit less than it did last year means you're playing, even the games you win, you're playing closer. They've had, you know, weeks where they've gone without that kind of 10-0 win where you don't have to worry about pitching David Robertson or Adam Ottavino or Brooks Raley. But, you know, they like a game like they played Sunday night against the Giants, they're up 5-1 in going into the seventh inning, and they still needed five relievers to get the last nine outs. They'd use all of their high leverage relievers to get the last nine outs. If they didn't have an off day on Monday, that game goes very differently and maybe goes south for them. The way they've had some other, you know, they've blown, I think, five leads of three runs or more since the start of June. I think it's just a team that did everything well last year. This year doesn't do anything well enough to compensate for anything else.
So when bad things happen to $440 million baseball teams, it becomes time to hear from the owner, right? And Steve Cohen decided it was time to meet with you guys, his friends in the New York media, the other day. And it was quite the extravaganza. I think we should start by getting to the bottom of one of the biggest issues. They took the normal desk that they make Buck Showalter sit at, and they moved it out of the room, and they had Steve Cohen sit at one of those little round high-top tables that I feel like you normally see them at fast food places in the airport. So, any idea what was going on there?
I guess they just wanted kind of a casual fry. I'm sure Point 72 has tons of those types of tables for a casual atmosphere during the workday at his hedge fund. I guess he didn't like the idea. You know, usually when he talks to the media, and he, you know, a mid-season conversation with Steve Cohen is not unprecedented, but usually it happens like he shows up on the road somewhere. He's just out by the dugout, and we start chatting with him, and all of a sudden all the recorders are out. This one, since he announced it on Twitter 24 hours before and said, "You'll hear it from me straight," they had to make it a little more formal in the press conference room at Citi Field. But also, they didn't want him sitting down and facing the cameras quite that way, I guess.
I guess. All right. Now, as someone who read that book on Steve Cohen, the hedge fund kingpin, it's called Black Edge. Incredible book. I was fascinated by his use of the word patient to describe himself in that press conference, because in the book, he didn't come off as particularly patient in his other life. Like, if you underperformed for his hedge fund in that life, you got fired. Boom. He woke up on Monday morning and thought, you're gone. It didn't matter who you were, what you'd done before. Boom. Why do you think that he's now adopted this patience persona in his baseball life? What does it mean for his team, for Buck Showalter, and for Billy Epler? Or is it not even really an accurate depiction of what he is? Will, let's start with you.
No, you know, I think it is sort of more or less accurate from what I gather. I think that internally, like, if you screw up there, like, or if, like, how the Mets have screwed up the whole season, pretty much, he's been on the phone with Billy Epler every day. He speaks with Buck Showalter. He asks questions. He does his own work too, and he tries to investigate what's going on with this ball club. And I think that's a huge, you know, that's the thing, that he's not a passive owner in that regard. He is very active with trying to figure this out on his own as well. But I think what he has learned is that sort of operation with, like, petulance or just, like, not being very patient, it's not going to fly in Major League Baseball. And you're going to turn away a lot of people that you probably want working for you that can turn things around and make your organization better. And I think that he has learned that, because if you look back, he was sort of that way, right, in the beginning with his tweets and some of the other reactions to things. He has learned that that's going to cost him. It's going to cost him more than the millions upon millions that he's spending for a roster that's not performing, because it's going to set him backward anyway. It doesn't help the issue for him to act that way. And from what I have gathered, he does largely rely on his baseball operations people to guide him toward this, whatever is going to work or not. And I think that's something that people, when they look at Steve Cohen and they read that book, because I know of other people in different front offices who have read that book and who read that book when Steve Cohen started to, when he bought the Mets, what people one from him publicly here, I think sometimes is for him to act like, you know, a George Steinbrenner-esque. And lately he has shown no indication that that's the way he's going to work these days. And I think it's refreshing in one sense, because he still wants to be sort of front facing. He wants to take accountability for it. He wants to, you know, level with fans a little bit, and he wants to, you know, show that he kind of gets it. But at the same time, he's not going to allow himself to be that sort of, you know, crazy owner, you know, the billionaire gone mad that people want him to be, because it's just not going to work here.
It really has been a learning process for him. I remember when I, you know, when he became the owner, and I started doing research into Steve Cohen. I read Black Edge. Also, I talked to Sheila Kolatkar, who wrote it, and some other people who knew Cohen well. And I remember one of them saying, you know, the thing I'm most interested in seeing is how he handles losing, because you can have the best baseball team in the league is going to lose 60 games or so. This is something he's not used to in his business. When he loses, you know, the only year he lost money in his hedge fund was 2008, when everyone lost money and he lost a lot less than everyone else. You know, we saw in 2021, like Will referenced, you know, there were tweets about not signing Kumar Rocker that were then cited in lawsuits against Major League Baseball. There was a tweet in August of that year criticizing his team's offense that did not go over well in the clubhouse. Executives who felt pressure from him a little bit in their public statements, that he was kind of leaning on them a little bit. So I think, you know, his experience that year and then in that offseason, finding out that not a lot of people in baseball wanted to work for him necessarily, that they really struggled to hire a top executive. They were looking for a president of baseball ops, didn't come through. They ended up hiring Billy Epler as their general manager after going through a lot of different candidates being turned down for interviews or denied permission to interview a bunch of people. I think he realized, okay, I've got to play this a little bit differently. And he knew going into that press conference Wednesday, like if he comes out and says, yeah, we're firing Billy, we're firing Buck, we're raising this to the ground and starting over, that the pool of candidates to start over with would be relatively slim, even slimmer than a couple of years ago. So I think that's been a real learning process for him over the years and how he's evolved now in his third year as an owner.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Yeah, and I'm often wondering, like, do you have nowhere to go when you effectively walk in with a blank check, right? I mean, it's like, here it is, you know, there's no learning curve. I'm just going to buy my way into this sort of space. But when you look back and, like, I wonder, like, what do you think he could have done investment-wise differently, right? You kind of got the top free agent pitcher, you know, granted, you know, in that ballpark. You know, what do you think? You know, use of money, use of funds, was it just sort of a bad year? How do you see how the money was used in your evaluation? I'll start with you, Tim.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can go back maybe even to previous off seasons and wonder if they had the best long-term plan. You know, the signings they made prior to the 2022 seasons that all paid dividends in 2022. And that was, you know, signing Max Scherzer, signing Starling Marte and Mark Cannon and Eduardo Escobar, kind of going that veteran route. You knew that at the other side of those contracts might not age gracefully. I think, you know, a bunch of them were shorter term deals, but they haven't aged gracefully already in year two. You know, I think Mets fans still go back to that first offseason when JT Realmuto was available and they signed James McCann instead and gave him a bigger deal than most people expected. You know, this past winter, they kind of doubled down on their age strategy in the starting rotation with Verlander, but you know, I hear some people say, oh, you can't sign a 40-year-old starter And then, you know, like Justin Verlander was over the hill last year. He won the Cy Young last year. It's not like the, you know, sometimes the Mets of old would be bringing in Adrian Gonzalez to play first base, and they'd say, All-Star, 7 years ago, Adrian Gonzalez is starting for us. It's last year's Cy Young winner in Justin Verlander. You know, Scherzer had the best ERA of his career last year for them. So I'm not sure you look at how they spent and say it was wholesale the wrong idea of how they went about it. But you can certainly look at their strategy and say, well, if you're spending this much, why wouldn't you sign an extra reliever or two? You know, you're already over the highest threshold. How much does the difference between a $440 million luxury tax penalty and 445, you know, you're there. So I think you can quibble with the strategy in that regard and maybe go back a few years and say you could have laid it out maybe a little bit better over a longer term.
Yeah, it's funny. I was remembering just what Scott Boras told me during the winter meetings when you know, the Mets were making a frenzy of moves, and I had asked him just about Brandon Nimmo, and he's like, you know, like, Will, teams that are spending like the Mets are not going to leave a glaring hole in center field, are they? And it's like, well, no, but they may leave one in the sixth inning, apparently. So I guess that's funny to me. But, you know, to your question, Doug, you know, I look at this last offseason as not sort of like hugely critical of where the money was spent. It was more like, okay, this is where they have to spend the money sort of thing, because this farm system is not at the level where they're going to have anybody from the minor leagues being able to give them any significant innings, it looks like, at least right away, or at least in the first half. That was a given. So like their development of pitchers, that's something where they have made strides in sort of trying to develop and trying to put some money and invest toward. But they're starting from basically zero there. They did not inherit a great program, or really any program. We see a lot of teams with pitching labs. The Mets did not have that either. So they didn't really have the infrastructure in place to really rely on young talent. And then they traded away a lot of guys, frankly, before last offseason as well, that may have come back to haunt them a little bit. So I don't really criticize all the moves that they made to kind of rack up this huge payroll. For me, I look at it as they sort of tried to thread the needle, or they did try to thread the needle between wanting to retain this competitive window while also looking ahead to the future and saying, okay, maybe down the road, these contracts are not so crazy because they're, you know, a lot of money in the short term, like a Verlander, like a Scherzer, where we can get these guys off the books in a couple of years and then maybe look toward a longer term plan here. So I don't criticize it too much. It's just like what Tim was saying. I think they're getting hurt by some of their moves even before this past offseason.
All right. So Steve made clear in that press conference, he's not firing Buck. He's not firing Billy Epler during the season. But over the long haul, if this keeps up, which of those two is in the most danger of losing his gig after this season?
Yeah, it was kind of a weird vote of confidence for both of them, because while it was, you know, I'm absolutely keeping them all season, with your general manager, you're saying, I'm going to hire a president of baseball operations above him at some point. And if you're a manager hearing that, you know, that guy might want his own manager in here as well. So I would say probably Showalter is probably in more immediate peril at the end of the season, because, you know, if the Mets were to bring in a president of baseball operations, you know, is David Stearns available at the end of the season? Is that the name that people are thinking about, maybe? That Steve Cohen all but said on Wednesday. So, you know, if they were to bring in someone in that role, you can imagine that person maybe doesn't have history with Buck Showalter, maybe decides, you know, that there's one more year on Showalter's contract after this one. That's typically a time when a team decides, you know, do we give him an extension so that he's not a lame duck manager in the last year of his deal, or do we decide to go in a different direction? And if you can imagine, if the Mets finish under 500 or have this disappointing season, a new president of baseball ops might opt to go in his own direction there. I think Epler, probably, even if he, you know, they bring in someone above him, would still have a role in the front office. A guy who has done really well in terms of pro scouting at other stops in his career. And so maybe, you know, he fits that niche for them, even if they bring in someone to be the head of baseball operations.
Yeah, let me ask you guys about Buck. I've known Buck a long time. Like, I'm familiar with how it's ended in other places. I also know and I've thought this forever, he's the most prepared man ever to manage a big league baseball team that I've ever met. And his attention to detail is ridiculous. And yet this team's attention to detail feels like it's maybe the worst of any Buck Showalter team that I've ever watched. So, you know, I read Britt Drolley's piece about him the other day, great interest. What do you think has changed in Buck and in the way he goes about it this year versus last year? Will, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. When you look at this team, they look like they're a team that's just like undisciplined on the field, where they're making silly mistakes. And it's interesting because I talked to Max Scherzer about just the run that the Nationals went on a few years ago, because that's kind of the situation that the Mets face themselves in if they ever want to be looked at as a legitimate contender here in the second half. They have to make that sort of crazy run and look like that. And what he said was, you know, we got to start doing like little things. Like, we got to do all those little things first. And then the big things, it's amazing how they could just start to fall off, it looks like. And for the Mets, I mean, there's been like, there's been pitch clock violations. They are like one of like two teams that have like a shift violation called against them for Jeff McNeil placing his foot on the wrong side of the bag. They've thrown the ball to the wrong base coming from the outfield. They've been stealing bases at weird times. Thinking back to that Brandon Nimmo attempted steal against the Tigers with basically the game on the line there. It doesn't look great. And it's hard for it not to fall back on the coaching staff and the manager, right? Because that's what people think of. But when you talk to the players, they really do push back on that. And it's interesting to me because it's not a place where I feel like he has lost guys, because they all vouch for him. And, you know, you have these conversations with guys that you know now for a little while, and you get the confidence in them that they're going to tell it to you straight. And so it's not like they're just publicly voicing support. It's like, these are private conversations that I'm having with some guys. And it's not like they're throwing him under the bus. And in fact, they're pushing back when a column comes out, ripping him for bullpen usage or stuff like that. I was telling Tim the other day that I had a couple of guys in that clubhouse just reach out to me personally and just ask me to come over and talk. And they will go out of their way almost to defend Buck Showalter with his usage of guys and things of that nature. So for me, that's one of the more interesting things, is that he hasn't lost guys, it seems. But at the same time, if you watch this team play, it defies that. And it's like, well, what is it? And it's one of those mysteries about this team that I really don't have a great answer for.
Yeah, like I wonder if it's almost human nature. You're coming off 100, you know, when Buck Showalter comes in at the start of the 2022 season, the Mets in 2021 looked relatively undisciplined. There was kind of the idea that Luis Rojas was not a strong enough personality in the room to corral some bigger personalities that the Mets had acquired that season. And you come in 2022, they come off of an 85 loss season, a season in which their flaws were readily apparent, especially in the second half of the year. And you buy right into, okay, this guy's going to pay a whole other level of attention to detail. We want to buy into that. And you stick with it for 162 games and into a postseason berth. And then you get to the next spring training, and just naturally, you're not going to care quite the same way. Even though you've got, you know, so many more things. Like Jason, I'm sure you talk to Buck as much as any manager in spring training about the pitch clock, about the new rules and all that. And yet here they are. Last I checked, 7 or 10 days ago, they were third in the league in violations. And part of that is having veterans who are not or less used to it than maybe some guys who came up through the minors. But, you know, they clearly, whatever time they spent on, they needed to spend a little bit more to get used to it. I think, you know, it's not that the players have been, I don't want to say complacent, but I think there is kind of a human nature element to it that, you know, we did all these things for a year, so they should be secondhand to us. And I don't know that they have been, so clearly by the way they played.
Well, I mean, and, you know, I called three of the games at the end of the season last year. So even though we look at the 101 wins, it's hard not to look at that series in Atlanta against the Braves, which was just like epic, like disappointment, you know, even though they were close games. You know, do you think the Mets would be in a whole different mindset and situation had that gone a little bit differently? Like, they ended up getting, you know, tied, and then the Braves just passed them, and it was like, wait a minute, how did they not win this division? You know, and I remember talking to Brian Snitker, and he's like, well, in some ways it was good that the Mets got so far out in front that we kind of figured out who we were. We were able to just kind of play in the sandbox while they're up there stressing out about like getting caught. And then they got caught. So I'm wondering, do you think that tone that was set in that final series where it was really mano a mano and they came up on the short side kind of bled into, you know, this season, because they would have been in a whole different situation if they had they won that division.
You know, usually I wouldn't think that way. Like, usually I'd be more analytically minded and think like, okay, no, there has to be some other sort of way to think through this. But talking with enough people like around the Mets who observe even more than I do, and I try to be there almost every day, there is an element to that, I think. And I think that from like a psychological standpoint, yes. And I think if you were to sort of like write a book about this team, you start with that. Like, you start with the Braves series, you start with them getting eliminated against the Padres. And I think back to like those scenes in the clubhouse after that elimination and them dropping that series against the Padres, you know, they were guys that almost, I don't want to say accepted it, but it didn't have that sort of like depressing feel to it where like you just walked into a scene where, you know, guys are frustrated, clearly agitated at the loss, that their season's over. Tim and I have talked about it in the past. It almost felt like a end of the year, sort of end of the school year vibe to it, where like, oh, you know, I'll see you later kind of thing. And guys are like drinking beer and having some pizza after the series and stuff. So I think you start there, and I think that it only makes sense. And when you add to the Diaz injury and like you have Justin Verlander start the year in the IL for the entire month of April, I look at it as you just never had a good feeling about this team. You never had like that feeling like, okay, here's the light has come on and here come the Mets. Hasn't happened that way at all. And I think it does sort of date back to last year.
Yeah, the thing I was really fascinated about going into the season was how they would respond to that first real spell of adversity. Because you looked at what happened to them last season for really, what was it, 156 games. They didn't really have that adversity. Then they lose, they get swept in that series in Atlanta. They played three against the Nationals at home. I think they swept that series. I kind of forget, honestly. And then they lose the series to the Padres. They didn't really have a chance to rebound from that huge disappointment in Atlanta. And I remember a player telling me, I think it was after the Padres series, that, you know, we just never really recovered from that. That really knocked us back. And we didn't have time to collect ourselves before we're in another do or die situation against San Diego. And like Will said, you know, the vibe at the end of the season after the loss to San Diego was a little weird. Like, it wasn't, you know, we've been in the clubhouses of teams whose seasons have come to an end in the postseason. And it's generally a little bit quieter and more somber. And it just seemed like they'd already accepted that this was the likely outcome. Even if it wasn't against the Padres, it would have been in the next round or, you know, they no longer viewed themselves as kind of a pennant contender, a World Series contender. And then this season, you know, we've seen them knocked back to a different degree during the regular season, and they haven't quite known exactly how to respond to that yet. That, you know, a tough stretch at the end of April bled into some series losses to bad teams in May, which bled into a 7-19 June. That they just had, you know, they had, I think, a 5-game winning streak, all of 5 1-run wins against the Rays and Guardians in late May. But outside of that, they just haven't been able to build any kind of positive momentum to get back on their feet, you know, get back to 500, build themselves back into a wild card race here. So we haven't seen them show that ability quite yet.
All right. I think we put off the trade deadline talk long enough. Steve Cohen could not have stated this more clearly. If they don't have a big run here in the next few weeks, there's no way they're buying. So if we assume nothing dramatic changes either way between now and like July 26th, what does their approach to the deadline look like? Do they just sell? Do they buy and sell? I just wonder if there's a chance they're the selling team to watch, where Max Scherzer's out there, Justin Verlander's out there, almost everyone on the roster not named Francisco Alvarez or Edwin Diaz are out there. What do you guys see? Tim, let's start with you.
I think there's probably like three levels of selling for them. And the first is kind of the basic sale where, okay, it's impending free agents. So that's David Robertson. It's Tommy Pham. It's maybe Mark Canna or Adam Ottavino, who's got a player option. Omar Narvaez. Pieces that, you know, can help another team but probably aren't bringing you back a starting second baseman for, you know, a starting position player for you. Then there's the next level, which is Scherzer and Verlander. We've seen trades kind of like that happen in the past. Verlander himself, when he went from Detroit to Houston, where Detroit took on some of the money. Houston, when they got Zach Greinke, took on some of the money from Arizona. So there's blueprints there. I would imagine it would be pretty difficult to negotiate both of those guys to trade both of them at the deadline. So maybe they decide to move one of those pieces and pay down some of the 2024 salary. At the same time, probably try to get pieces back that help them in the near term. And then the third level would be like blowing it up and like you said, including basically everyone on the major league roster as available. Pete Alonso is a year and a half from free agency. Jeff McNeil just signed an extension, but maybe you look to move him at probably a low point in his value. Basically anyone who's not under contract through 2030, like Lindor and Nimmo and some of your younger pieces would be available. I don't see them going that far. I don't think, one season removed from 100 win team makes you decide to blow it up quite to that extent. But I think the first two options are pretty much on the table at this point.
Yeah. Jim Bowden has argued in The Athletic that they should trade both Verlander and Scherzer. I have a hard time seeing that. And the reason is next year, which you guys have written about. I mean, what's the plan next year? It's still to win. It's still to go all in and to sign Ohtani. So does trading Verlander or Scherzer or both say to Shohei Ohtani, hey, here's a team you can win the World Series with?
Yeah, that's kind of like what I think of too when I think of the Mets and their trade deadline situation this year, because they're in that situation, right, Jason, where like you're trying to thread that needle that I mentioned earlier of staying competitive. That's why you have this roster, this nucleus of players to kind of get you over to that sort of bridge, as Cohen likes to put it, to that other side where like you have some young players like Alvarez. Maybe you continue to do that. I will say like what Tim was hinting at with like paying down the cost, we've already seen that Steve Cohen is going to do that. He has already done that. He did that a couple of weeks ago with Eduardo Escobar. He could do that again. And frankly, I'm sure he will, because that, from what I've been told, like the Mets want to acquire players here regardless. Like they want to, if they're going to not make a move here in the standings, they want to beef up their farm system a little bit here. And I think a way to do that, from talking with some small market teams as well, you tell them that, hey, like we're going to buy down, Mark Hanna for you. Their eyes will light up because like they need, there's so many teams that need a guy like that. That frankly, like he lost playing time here to Tommy Pham. So the Mets aren't using him really. And if they continue to dwindle and they continue to languish here, obviously they had no use for him. So it would only make sense, that kind of move. Same with like a David Robertson, like Tim mentioned, Pham as well. But yeah, I think that's something that shouldn't be taken lightly, that ability to just absorb that contract no matter what it is. And Steve Cohen even said the other day, I consider it money already spent. I don't know many other owners who will say that kind of thing. They're playing in a different realm here, the Mets, where like they have such options here that it falls really a lot of pressure on this front office to like get things that matter in return, like get players that are good, like evaluate well and strike a good deal here. I think it puts a lot of pressure on them to do that, because that's what has to get done here.
How about the I guess the silver lining in the sense, or the blue and orange lining or whatever it is, but of just like, or like an Alvarez, or I mean, I guess, is there anyone you kind of circle to say, yeah, this is someone who's emerged but also can be part of this core, so that when they do get to the right formula, there's a new anchor in that youth movement. Looking at the All-Star game, so many great young players. I'll start with you, Tim. Like, any thoughts in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, the silver lining to a season where you're out of contention, and let's say, they start selling in late July, is you get, not only have Alvarez and Brett Beatty been up for most of the season now, but you can give kind of a look at some of your other younger players. Mark Vientos, who's gotten just kind of two sips of coffee at the major league level at this point. Ronnie Mauricio, a player that a lot of fans have liked what he's done at AAA, especially, off of a really good winter ball season for him. You give those guys a little bit of a runway. It's really hard to give young players runway in a major market like New York when you're trying to win. So this could give you a 2-month audition for those guys. You know, to this point, Alvarez has been the shiniest thing that they've gotten at the major league level as a young player. It's not, you know, the month of May he had was just a superb offensive month for any position player, let alone a 21-year-old catcher. And then what he's done defensively also at this level and the strides he's made there, there was some thought, you know, maybe he's not a long-term defensive catcher. And instead, he's been able, like he's shown off a great arm behind home plate. His framing numbers are near the top of the league. So just as a receiver, as a defender, and as an all-around player, he's opened a lot of eyes.
Yeah, Will?
Yeah, I think also somebody to keep in mind is Kodai Senga. That's somebody from you know, the offseason that they actually more or less have hit on in a way that, you know, scouts kind of when I spoke to them about the pros and cons of him and like maybe the highs and lows that he could offer, he showed probably more highs than lows. He's not somebody that I would count on in a playoff series right now. But to like what Jason was saying about next year, like if you could add another like pitcher, preferably under the age of 35, to kind of go into this rotation, who's pretty good, then all of a sudden, like looking at maybe Kodai Senga as your third or fourth guy again, and you know, he's somebody under a 5-year contract, only 30 years old. His numbers resemble Yu Darvish to this point in Yu Darvish's career. And so I think that gives you a glimmer of hope there that maybe you got something right with that signing and maybe become even better for you next year and be more of an impact starter for you.
All right. One last thing for me. We've kind of danced around this. Steve Cohen, he said flat out, he still wants to hire a president of baseball ops, which is something he's been trying to do. This would be the third year in a row. And he never actually mentioned the name of David Stearns, but is David's availability the biggest reason that might really happen this winter? Will, you covered David when he was the president of baseball ops for the Brewers. He stepped back from that role this season. Do you think that David Stearns wants to be the man working for Steve Cohen running the Mets? And if he does, how big a difference would he make or could he make?
Talking with people from around the Brewers, especially like this past week since the Brewers were in town, you kind of get yes and no on that as to like whether David Stearns, who, by the way, is not commenting on this whatsoever, like he is not touching it. And frankly, like he really can't since he is also still under contract with the Brewers. So like there's nothing really that he is going to say there regardless. But when you talk to people who have worked with him long enough to probably know, they say yes and no. One, he likes his life right now. Like he's enjoying life. It's good. But the Mets job presents a situation perhaps where he kind of gets the best of both worlds, where, you know, you can lead baseball operations without like the day-to-day responsibilities of like a Billy Epler who handles probably, I don't know how many media requests or reporters hitting him up for information, that kind of thing. You're not maybe as front-facing. We see other organizations where the GM takes a lot of those phone calls or a lot of those media responsibilities. We see that with the Rays a lot, right? Where you know, Peter Bendix has taken that responsibility a little bit off of Neander's shoulders or whoever else has been there. And that could happen with the Mets as well, especially if they decide to retain Billy Epler. So I think that part of it, and also dealing with the amount of resources that the Mets would give David Stearns, which would be obviously an extreme from what he was dealing with Milwaukee. And that makes me think that, man, if you put David Stearns in that situation, he's somebody that I learned so much, and I'm thankful that that was my first beat reporting job with covering David Stearns and Craig Counsell, because I learned so much about how to run a functional organization and maximize your roster, frankly. And I think that's something that David Stearns did really well with a small market. Everybody on the 40-man roster had a purpose. They had a role. And when it was open or when it was full, you knew the reasons why and where they can go from there. Sometimes with the Mets, we've seen some guys who have been on their 40-man for too long that maybe they, I don't want to say wasted a spot, but they could have done better at. David Stearns always maximized his 40-man roster. You kind of always got the impression that he was in control of situations. The only blemish that comes to mind with me with David Stearns is the Hader trade from last summer. And not necessarily because he made that trade. It was more about the miscalculation that he admitted to of underestimating the effect that would have on his clubhouse. That to me was really interesting because it's not something that I would have expected him to do. He's somebody that I always thought was in control of the situation. So that part of it, but the trade more or less was, I would guess, an ownership situation. And it says more of the way that they view contending from year to year than it does David Stearns having a miss on a trade. So I think that if you put him in a situation with the Mets where he has these resources, man, it would be exactly what they needed, frankly.
Yeah, David's really good. All right, we can't let you go without hearing Tim's story on why it was he never finished that William Faulkner book that he quoted from. Tim, explain this.
It's If I Forget Thee, Jerusalem. It's a good Faulkner book. I liked the part that I read, but the copy I had from the university bookstore, you know, you always flip to the end of the book and see like, okay, how many pages is this book? And it's like 260 or something, which is a reasonable amount for length for a book. And it ended at the end of a chapter. So, you know, there's no like blank pages at the back of the book, but I thought, okay, it ends kind of abruptly, but whatever. And then I go in to take a test on the book and I get, you know, it's a 20 question test and all the questions from like 14 on are about stuff I don't remember happening at all. And I find out the book is like 350 pages. And there were 90 pages my copy did not have. I've been meaning to, you know, that was about 15 years ago. I've been meaning to go back and finish it, but I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Hey, stuff happens when you buy those used books. It's a pretty exactly. All right, Tim, well, you guys are heroes. It's so hard to cover a team like yours. You both do it so well. So I hope everyone out there listening will read both of you religiously, especially over these next few weeks, if only to see what other books Tim will quote from that he hasn't read.
The specialty.
Yeah. So guys, thank you. Please come back and visit us again sometime. I'm thinking the Mets will continue to be a topic.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. One more great product from LinkedIn. You're there to network, you're there to look for jobs, you're there to post jobs. And how about LinkedIn Sales Navigator? It's a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals such as job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and shows you hidden allies so you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date, first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/baseballshow. That is linkedin.com/baseballshow for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/baseballshow and get started. Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB show.
Okay, it's that time again. it is time for listener trivia, our way of involving you, our favorite listeners in this show. You know, Doug, we're coming off a rare defeat last week, but I actually blame the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster. I mean, think about it. We're on a roll. Tim leaves town for a week. We go crashing down to trivia defeat. Now, what do you think, Doug? Like, when we get these wrong nowadays, it can't be our fault, can it?
Yeah, we could. Can we have him impeached or something like that for some sort of violation? I don't know, with the mayor. But that's right. So we can look at our record with our mayor, and then it's much shinier than alternate mayors that come in and swoop down. Right. Yeah, so that's I feel good about it.
Yeah, there's no question that trivia questions we get wrong are a black mark on the resume of the mayor, right? Because all I know is when the mayor has been in town, we're 10 and 3 in trivia since the start of spring training. What are we when he's gone? We're 0-1. Do the math.
Okay. That's it.
I have to admit,
Do we have our own analytics department in Starkville? We need to get one.
We need one, yeah. We need one. Get on that, Glanville.
I will.
All right. I actually don't like our odds of getting back on track this week either, having seen the question, but you never know. So let's welcome in this week's special trivia guest star. It is Mark Snyderman, who actually emailed us his question. Mark, welcome to Starkville.
Thanks. Thrilled to be here.
We're thrilled to have you here. Mark, why don't you tell us a little about yourself, where you're from, what team do you care about most?
Sure. I live in Atlanta now, where I have lived for 26 years, but I'm born and raised in Chicago, and so lifelong Cubs fan.
All right. Well, I know the Cubs aren't the only thing you care about, because you also care about a stat that I don't think has ever made it into any of our trivia questions before this week. That's about to change. All right, so Mark, why don't you hit us with your question?
Sure. The stat is WHIP, and I am in love with WHIP. I have been an analytics fan for many years. I used to read Bill James baseball abstracts in the 80s, but I particularly like those statistics that are elegant and powerful in a simple way. And WHIP is just an amazing statistic, and I'm not quite sure why it took so long for it to become a regular statistic in baseball, given how simple it is. But anyway, here's the question, and it has to do with best single season WHIP. Going back to 1900, only two pitchers have ever had at least 200 innings in a season and finished the season with a WHIP below 0.80. Name them.
0.80.
Okay, so for anybody listening who doesn't know what WHIP is, it's a very simple concept. Walks plus hits per innings pitched. So if you have a WHIP under 0.80, it means you're only allowing four base runners for every five innings you pitch. And that means you're historically dominant. Yeah. It also means this is really hard, this question. And I see two reasons it's hard.
Well, especially 1900.
it goes back to 1900 when it felt like everybody had a WHIP under one. The second thing is, Doug, I don't see any way that you can employ one of your sneaky cheating schemes. Am I right?
No, there's too many people out there. I think it's...
I will give you one way you might... want to do that.
I mean, I have a good guess. I think we both have a good guess, but I don't think we have a good
Let's work. Why don't we work through this a little bit and then look for some guidance? Okay.
Let's work through it. All right.
Okay. So my first thought was that it happened last year with Justin Verlander, who I believe set a record for lowest WHIP in a single season. But then I started thinking, with the 200 inning cutoff, I think he falls short because he got hurt late in the year.
So
I'm going to assume he's out. My other thought for an active pitcher, Doug, is Clayton Kershaw. I'm pretty sure he's the owner of the lowest WHIP of the live ball era for a career. I'm not sure if he has any seasons under 0.8, but
good guess.
Depending on what hints we can get out of Mark, we should keep him. And after him, it feels to me like it gets almost impossible. You know, if you think about the most dominant seasons of fairly modern times, all right, it has to be by guys who throw strikes so they don't run their whip up with a bunch of walks. Then Pedro comes to mind and Maddox comes to mind.
Yep.
Before them, Bob Gibson, right? Because he had the historic 1.12 ERA.
Yep.
I thought about Koufax, but he had some seasons, you know, where
a lot of innings. Yeah.
He had trouble throwing strikes, you know, really early in his career, especially more than people remember. So got to keep that in mind. And if we're going to go way back in time, Walter Johnson feels like my best guess. Because he had some seasons in there where the stats were absurd. And don't forget Addie Joss. I don't remember when his career ended, but he's number one all time in WHIP. I just don't know if he had any seasons after 1900. Well,
didn't they throw like 510 innings a season then back then? So they definitely had the innings, probably.
You're right.
Like three walks and 12 strikeouts and 512 innings.
All right. So, like, those are my names. Do you want to throw names out there or do you want to have?
I try to think of dominant seasons that could come from anywhere, right? Yeah. Someone who just was like, where did this guy come from? I don't know, like a Jake Arrieta. I mean, he probably walked a lot of people, but he was awfully unhittable. Too many walks. Fergie was didn't walk anybody. So did he have like a one hits. Something year? Right? Too many hits. Yeah, he gave a lot of hits, Homer. But I have Maddox. I'm feeling very strongly about Pedro, though. I mean, come on, that season was ridiculous. I gotta feel like Pedro is a good guess, like Pedro. Yeah. You know. So
like Pedro,
I mean, I'm just
99, throwing it out there. Pedro 2000, something like that.
2000 to 99. Come on.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Maddox could be that guy, right? Because he. You know, did he have like a one something in a year? I mean, I'm sure he did. He ever get a one ERA?
Maddox, he sure did.
Yeah. Okay. Like 8-1.
94 Maddox, 94-95 was just crazy good.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are the two names. I mean, Bob Gibson. I have the same one. Bob Gibson, Greg Maddox, Pedro Martinez.
Okay. All right. Let's. All right, Mark. We're nowhere on this, so let's ask for some hints.
Okay.
Anybody
years?
Okay. No, it's nobody active.
Okay, figured that.
In fact, they're both in the Hall of Fame.
Okay,
which is not surprising.
Both in the Hall of Fame, but that everybody would guess was in the Hall of Fame. So, anybody from the dead ball era?
What do you? Yes.
19. That'd be 1900 to 1919.
Yes.
That's a yes.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Okay.
And then, Greg Maddox is still alive, so he's in the live ball era.
Turned his era into the dead ball era, but it wasn't technically the dead ball era. In 1900 to 1919, wasn't Walter Johnson in there, Doug? Again, I can't remember if Addie Joss.
I will not help. I can't help you on this turn. Babe Ruth?
Babe Ruth's a really good guess. Babe Ruth was so good, but I don't know if he ever pitched 200 innings.
200 innings, yeah, probably not.
But, you know, in my Stark Truth book, there is the story
of Cy Young. What year did Cy Young pitch?
Cy Young was pitching in the after 1900, sure. Okay. Pitched in the 1903 World Series. So Cy Young, Addie Joss, Walter Johnson. It's the Addie Joss thing that's really haunting me because I know he holds the career record. I've looked at this list too many times.
Well, that's a good guess. Okay, then. I like Pedro though.
One guess
ridiculous. So
you like okay, what, you like right, Addie Johnson, Addie Joss, Walter Johnson, or Cy Young?
Oh my gosh! I mean, you got to go with the all-time WHIP leader. I mean, if you're the all-time WHIP leader, you had to have a good year in there.
I mean, it's just whether he pitched after 1900, but
doing up.
All right, we'll keep him aside. Okay, the other one, Mark. Can you give us any rough feel for the era that was done?
I will say that there's a very long period of time between when these two pitchers accomplished this.
Yeah.
Okay. So like 1901 versus 1995 would be a long time, or 2000.
I guess
would be a
maybe
long
it's time. Like, did I face this guy? Is that a fair question? I faced this guy.
Ooh.
Did I play against
you
this
might
guy?
Have. I don't know. Is that? You might have. Yeah.
You might have. Okay. Well, you didn't face Gibson. So, all right. So we're into Pedro or Maddox territory. I'm going to let you pick.
No, I've been sticking with Pedro from jump. This is because I just think he's that season was just like I remember covering it and discussing it later at ESPN and like the greatest pitching season.
Yeah,
it's always on there, and it's like he was ridiculous. So I'm just gonna go. I'll stick with Pedro. I just don't know about the 1900 dude. So
yeah, all right. So yeah, we're gonna go Pedro, and you want to go Addy Just. That's a really
He's an all-time.
All right, we're gonna do
these
it.
These are great guests.
We're gonna look smart, even if we get it wrong.
Yes, that's but the key. We look.
I don't know how we can get this right. We have literally no clue, but we're required to guess. So, Mark, is there any chance that it's Pedro and Addy Joss?
You are so close.
Oh no!
Pedro is correct.
And Walter Johnson?
Addy and Walter Johnson.
Oh, no.
But okay. Let me tell you how close it was, because Addy Joss in 1908 had a whip of .806.
Oh, no.
And 325 innings.
See, the mayor might give us – mayor has what to was, give us like
– I have to tell Walter you all about participation ribbon. Yeah. Justin Verlander came unbelievably close. In 2019 – His if you go to two decimal places, his whip was 0.80, but that's not below 0.80. So,
wow. I feel good about this though. I mean,
It's like a moral victory.
Yeah,
it was Walter Johnson.
1913. Wow. And Pedro was 2000.
That is crazy that he.
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
it took 100 years. Wow.
The Walter Johnson one, right? 0.780, 346 innings.
Is that all?
Oh, so
kind of cut back that year.
Yeah, Pedro was 0.74. Pedro is the all-time single season leader.
Well, what's the lowest? What was like Maddox's lowest? And
Maddox's lowest was 0.81 in 1995, and he had over 200 innings.
Okay, amazing. So we were all around it.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it's really kind of a moral victory. On the other hand, you know, we have lost two in a row going into the All-Star break. Doug, you got some experience with this. Does that put you in the danger zone at all?
Well, we're just going to be a reserve instead of voted as a starter, but that's okay. we'll come off the bench. We're good.
All right. Who's better at trivia than us? But whatever. Here's the thing. It doesn't matter if we get these questions right or wrong, because either way, this segment gets way more entertaining once we're through thrashing around and guessing, because it's time to bring in the mayor of Starkville. He's back, Tim McMaster, and he will play another classic play-by-play clip involving this week's answer. So, Tim, what Walter Johnson clip do you have for us?
I do not have a Walter Johnson clip. I didn't even look. I was like, should I give it the shot at some old like radio thing? And then no. So the problem with Pedro is that Pedro is the answer to so many of these questions. We've used a lot of like the great Pedro, right? Including his famous 17 strikeout game against the Yankees in the Bronx. So I didn't want to bring that one back because I think we've used it twice. But in 2000, he struck out 17 Tampa Bay, then Devil Rays at Fenway.
Yeah.
So we're going to go with that. Mm.
Pedro Martinez, a record of 5-0 and a 1.27 ERA as he makes his sixth start of the year.
The 1-2 pitch. He struck him out.
The 0-2 pitch. Swing and a miss. He got him on a high fastball.
2-2 pitch. He struck him out. That's 17 for Pedro, matching his single game high. A 1-2-3 ninth for Martinez. He departs after 9 innings to a standing ovation.
Some Joe Castiglione, some Sean McDonough.
Yeah.
I think Charlie Slows on the Marlins called.
Yes, that's exactly right. You got a little montage of great voices. Very, really good. That was really fun. And Mark, so well done, my friend. Thank you for listening. Thank you for emailing. Thanks for the kind words in your email. Thanks for joining us on in Starkville. Please come back again sometime.
It was my pleasure. I hope I can come back. Take care.
All right.
That'd be great.
Appreciate it.
Just remember, you too can be part of these trivia segments, just like Mark Snyderman. We'll tell you how to do that in just a few minutes.
Strange but true.
So last week in this segment, we never got around to L.A. De La Cruz's incredible cycle for the Reds, because the next day after that, a 25-1 game broke out. But I feel like we missed out on the chance to talk about that. It was so good. So we're going to circle back to it for that reason, because, Doug, I wrote a piece the other day arguing it was the most thrilling cycle ever. A lot of people I noticed wanted to argue that point, but you would never argue that point, would you?
No, can't argue it.
Okay, I had my reasons. I even tried to prove it. Okay, so let's just run through some of the reasons that I made the case. This was the most exciting cycle ever. Okay, so first of all, he hit a ball 116.6 miles per hour. And that wasn't even the home run. It was the double. It was the first hit. And here's a little quiz for you, Doug. In the StatCast era, how many balls have been hit harder than that in any cycle?
Oh, in any cycle? Oh, that's got to be 0.0.
Zero. Zero.
0.0.
The previous highest was Christian Yelich hit 110.9 miles an hour in one of his cycles against the Reds. But 116.6, that is a record. But that was just the first hit of the cycle. And it was really the last hit that was truly electrifying. So Ellie De La Cruz comes to bat. He needs a triple for the cycle. And guess what happens next?
De La Cruz, right center. Down base hit. Could he go free? In the air on third. India scores. It's a cycle! This rookie, in 2 weeks of the big leagues, posts the first cycle for a Red since 1989. Ellie Mania.
What a goosebumpy call there, huh? From John Sadak. It's a cycle. Love it.
That's great.
So great. Okay, so according to StatCast, Ellie De La Cruz went from home to third base in 10.83 seconds. It's the fastest time home to third on a triple in baseball this year. Actually tied for that with him. He also had another one, say 10.83. And so that got me thinking. I looked at every triple since StatCast began in which a runner went from home to third that fast. And here's what I found. Nobody has ever gone home to third that fast on any triple during a cycle since we've been keeping track. And so like that's kind of the basis for my argument for the most part. Since we've been measuring this stuff, Ellie De La Cruz hit a ball harder than anyone has ever hit a ball in a cycle. And he went home to third faster than anyone has ever gone home to third in a cycle. And he did them both in the same game. That is crazy. Crazy. And then just a couple other little things here. I heard this on the John Sadak call. The Reds had not hit a cycle in 34 years. So the other teams had hit for 122 cycles while they were hitting for none. And they allowed 9 cycles in that time, including 3 just to Christian Yelich. Okay, so that's part. Right. And this was their 12th win in a row. The triple drove in the winning run in the 12th win in a row. Nobody had ever hit for the cycle to extend a winning streak that long. And they were down 5-0 in that game to the Braves, and they won. And it's the only game the Braves haven't won in their last 17 games. Okay, so what do you think, Doug? Have I proved my case? Most thrilling cycle ever?
No, I was already sold it at the first time your column dropped. You know, just it's all good. I mean, this guy, De La Cruz, is ridiculous. And I've been following him on Twitter for a while. And I remember when Harold Reynolds did his special on him at MLB Network, I immediately texted him. I'm like, this guy, we just like went back and forth about how insane this player is. But De La Cruz is like, the best way I think of him is he's like a combination of like Deion Sanders, Chipper Jones, and like Cal Ripken or something. I mean, it's just like, cause he's like a big dude that can play short, you know, and he's a switch hitter with power from both sides, and he can fly, absolutely fly. So it's like, you know, it's almost like there's an Ohtani to this guy, you know, cause he can throw as well. So you're sort of like, wow, this guy really does everything at an exceptional level. First home run almost left Cincinnati. But, you know, the fact that this guy, I mean, just a mind-blowing talent. And, you know, you think of the All-Star game coming up and you're like, ah, oh, you know, great players. But then there's like, you know, players that are just going to change the game. And he feels like one of those players. So I get it. And, you know, I know John Chambi, our friend and colleague, doesn't like cycles because he thinks sometimes they're a little bit contrived, right? You slow down for the double. But when you had a triple, that's it. Like you end on a triple or you end on a home run, you got to tip your cap because it's just like, it's so hard. And he's done so many things already in his short career that just feel like it's like, wait a minute, are we in a new era? That's what it feels like. So, what a talent.
Yeah, cycles are overrated, but this one wasn't. overrated.
Exactly.
Like, think about it. He's the fastest guy in the league. And he's the biggest guy in the field. He's 6'5". Travis Kelce is 6'5". It's nuts. All right. Finally, just to review, how many cycles for Doug Glanville in all those exceptional years in the big leagues again?
No. Well, are we counting spring training? Because that would count.
No.
Because it was a great week. Spring training, hit for the cycle and hit a grand slam same week. None. Yeah. None in both counts, actually. No grand slams and no cycles. That count, at least.
Yeah, okay. And yes. So you had none. Ellie De La Cruz hit for the cycle in the 15th game of his career. Yeah. Is that fair?
Well, I think I'll have a grand slam next week, too, if I hadn't had one already.
Yeah. Oh, God. Have I mentioned I'd love to see him in the All-Star game? I think I have. Right, that's going to do it for this week's show. We'll be bringing you podcast magic just like this all season long on The Athletic Baseball Show, which is available in its entirety, absolutely free, everywhere you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to read my work, like why I think Ellie De La Cruz's cycle was the most thrilling cycle ever, or any of the great baseball coverage in The Athletic, here is how you can do that. Just go to theathletic.com/baseballshow. And if you're a new subscriber, you can sign up for a one-year subscription for just $1.99 a month for the next 12 months. But also remember, you too can be part of this podcast because every show, we pick a fun listener trivia question. Then that lucky listener gets to join us right here and prove once again, there's almost no baseball trivia question we can't get wrong, especially if you slip something in there about the dead ball era. So how could you do that? You can do what Mark Snyderman did this week. Email us at Starkville@theathletic.com. That's Starkville with an E on the end. Or you can check out my Facebook fan page. We've found two trivia contestants there in the last month. Or you can do what most people do if you haven't reached your Twitter scrolling limit for the day. You can send your questions to us via what is left of Twitter. Doug, you're still left on Twitter. So where could people find you?
Yeah, I wore a shirt. I should have a blue check mark on this shirt. I would kind of make it official.
Yeah, you should.
Next time. Yeah, I need a check mark. But I still have it for some reason. So we'll just say you can find me still at the same place you always have, at Doug Glanville, DougGlanville.
Yeah, that works. And you can start spelling my name, and then you don't have to even go through the whole thing. I am at Jason St. JaySonST. If you're tweeting, just hashtag those questions, hashtag StarkvilleQS. So, Doug, thanks for playing. Thanks to Tim Britton and Will Salmon for visiting us. Thanks to Mark Snyderman for the great trivia question. Thanks to the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster, for producing us and putting up with us. And thanks to you all for listening. Doug and I will see you soon. Starkville.